I would like to talk today about fault tolerance of bad quantum low density parity check codes. So here's the outline of my talk. So first of all, I will give a very brief introduction into classical and quantum low density parity check codes, and I will try to show their advantages and disadvantages. So then I will talk about Tanner graph representation of LDPC codes, and such representation is very useful for classical LDPC codes, and I believe it also gives us some insight into quantum LDPC codes. So then I proceed to some particular constructions of quantum LDPC codes. In particular, I will discuss a hypergraph product construction, which can be considered as a generalization of Torrey codes, and there is one very interesting example which shows that within this construction we can realize LDPC codes with limited weight of parity check matrix. At the same time, such codes have finite rate and distance scaling as square root of the block length. So then I will talk about generalizations of hypergraph product codes, which corresponds to rotated boundaries, periodic boundaries, and it's very similar to what happens with checkerboard codes. Then based on this hypergraph product code construction, I will formulate lower bounds on parameters of quantum LDPC codes, and finally I will talk about fault tolerance of quantum LDPC codes, and also I will show how Tanner graph representation becomes useful in this setting. So Torrey code is probably the most famous LDPC code, and so this code is defined basically on a square region, and here I define it in a way that basically qubits are dark and light grade squares, and then there are two stabilizer generators which are shown here, and all other stabilizer generators are formed by translations with periodic boundaries. So what's important here is that if we start combining such stabilizer generators, then we will obtain some kind of loops, but they will always be topologically different from the logical operators that run around the code, and basically they run around the torus, and basically they are always topologically distinct from the combination of stabilizer generators. Why this code is so interesting? Because basically this probably could lead to the most easy implementation in hardware. So it has the least requirement on the hardware, and in particular realizations were proposed in this paper. And in those realizations, basically you need to add ancilla qubits to your code. So here empty circles are qubits, and then fields circuits are circles. Empty circles are qubits, and field circles are ancillas. And then if you run this circuit repeatedly, you will achieve measurements of stabilizer generators, and basically this will preserve your quantum information. Of course, on top of that, we would also need to collect all the results of our measurements in order to run error correction, or in order to be able to basically to figure out where the errors are. So this construction is good because it has relatively very high threshold. Then furthermore, overhead of ancillas is also relatively small. So in principle, this seems to be the way to go, but this has a strong disadvantage, and disadvantage is that Torrey codes actually do not encode much information. And this paper actually established a bound, and this bound says that for any local stabilizer codes in two dimensions, if the product of k number of encoded qubits times the distance squared is of the order of block lengths of the code. So we cannot do any better than this one. So in this paper, there was a construction was proposed which achieved actually distance that was square root of block length times the logarithm of block length. But this construction was a non-local construction. So basically, it seems that if we want to encode more information into our code, the only way to go is to consider LDPC codes without this requirement of locality. Here, we can gain a lot of inspiration from classical LDPC codes because such codes actually are among the best codes for classical error corrections and correction. And probably the most famous example is the Gallagher code. And this code basically constructed in a way that the parity check matrix has fixed number of entries for rows and for columns. And the error correction for such codes is conveniently represented by tenor graphs. So basically, the top nodes correspond to bits, and then lower nodes correspond to syndromes or rows of the parity check matrix. And basically, the idea is to try to look at quantum codes from the same perspective and see if this will give us some insight. So first, I would like to formally define quantum error correcting codes. So for this presentation, it is actually convenient to represent codes as binary matrices. So, and this becomes possible for stabilizer codes because those are defined as some Hilbert spaces that are stabilized by abelian group. And this abelian group is formed by commuting Pauli operators G. And because these are Pauli operators, basically we can map them in this way to binary strings V and U. And basically the X component of the Pauli operator then maps to V, and Z component of the Pauli operator maps to U. So in such arrangement, the parity check matrix of 513 code looks like as follows. So basically, we have X and Z part of the parity check matrix, and as I said, how the correspondence to the Pauli operator. So basically, the rows of this matrix correspond to stabilizer generators. So then the commutativity of this matrix or commutativity of stabilizer generators can be easily checked by such matrix equation, which also corresponds to the symplectric product of rows of the parity check matrix. So the orthogonality can also be checked from this condition, or commutativity can be checked also from this condition. So then the errors can also be represented in such binary form simply because we keep measuring Pauli operators. So even if a non-Pauli error happened, we will project it to the kind of Pauli error eventually. So effectively, we can only deal with Pauli errors, which we again can map to the binary strings. Again, there is X part and Z part of our error. And then if we want to figure out the syndrome of some error, all we need to do is to multiply our parity check matrix constructed from stabilizer generator with the error. However, we have to multiply it with respect to the symplectic inner product. And then we need to identify dangerous errors in this way. So dangerous errors are those which basically are orthogonal to stabilizer generators. However, not all of those errors are really dangerous because there are so-called degenerate errors. So if error belongs to the stabilizer generator group, to stabilizer group, then such error is actually degenerate and it's not dangerous. So then we need to identify those non-dangerous, those dangerous, really dangerous errors. And that basically the weight of such error gives us the distance of the talk or tolerance to errors. So then returning to the standard graph representation, for example, Tori code can be represented in this way, where on upper part we can place qubits and on lower part we can place syndromes. And for Tori codes, we can actually deal with Z and X errors separately because it's a CSS code. So then basically what we need to do, we need to measure X syndromes in order to identify Z errors. And then in order to identify X errors, we need to measure Z syndromes. And for Tori code, it turns out that the two rounds of measurements in principle are enough if we do it. So basically, if two rounds of measurements are enough. So then, in principle, we can use the same Tanner graph representation for arbitrary code. And of course, it immediately becomes clear that we need to arrange non-local interactions between our qubits and, for example, ancillas. And one of the, for example, implementation was proposed in this paper, where it was suggested that we could place qubits and ancillas on a Tanner graph, then for superconducting qubits, actually the interactions can be induced simply by running wire between two qubits. So basically what we could do, we could hardwire this Tanner graph initially, so the interaction will be always on, and then to use dynamical decoupling techniques in order to decouple some of these ancillas from qubits at our will. And basically in this way, we can arrange all measurements in Z cycles for LDPC code. So I will define what is Z later, but basically in principle, the hardware could be arranged in a way that it would work for LDPC code. Of course, it's still ongoing research and one would need to do a lot of optimization here. However, we are very hopeful and this is our motivation to study LDPC codes. So the other problem that arises with LDPC codes is that the techniques that were very efficient for classical LDPC codes would not work here. For example, the most efficient technique is based on belief propagation. And here it fails because of the presence of loops in such Tanner graphs. And loops are always present for quantum codes, basically because they're related to the commutativity condition of the stabilizer generator. So those problems should be overcome. However, we are very hopeful. And then basically we can talk about LDPC codes and in principle they could surpass toric codes if everything works out. So then for this discussion, it's actually convenient to also to use a completely to eliminate all ancillas or eliminate all syndrome measurements from that graph representation and basically to also use such kind of graph. So this graph basically corresponds to qubits and we connect two qubits only if they share a syndrome. Then because we are considering LDPC limited codes, so they have limited weight for rows and columns. Here the weight for rows is defined by R and for columns by C. So because this weight is limited, then the connectivity or the degree of each vertex will be limited by this number. So as I will show you later, this will have consequences for the fault tolerance of such code. Furthermore, we can do the same trick for syndromes. We can make another graph in which points will correspond to syndrome, and then we will be connecting two points only if they share some qubit. Then such graph can answer the question how many rounds of measurements we need to do in order to measure all qubits. And it turns out that this problem is kind of related to the coloring of such graph in which vertices correspond to qubits. And basically it is known then from graph theory that we basically need this number of, we can use this number of colors plus one in order to color this graph, or this number also gives us the number of rounds of measurements that we'll need to do in order to measure all qubits. Just to mention this in passing, that this is also ongoing research, that in principle, one could also ask questions about topological order associated with Hamiltonians that would be constructed from such LDPC codes. And basically, we already checked that, for example, the approaches that used in this paper in order to characterize topological order in more conventional systems would also be applicable here. In fact, in this paper, they even formulate how the theory would look for graphs. So basically, what we see here that there are obvious advantages of LDPC code. First of all, compared to general quantum codes, they have simplified measurements because we need to measure relatively small number of qubits. Then again, we will also have some benefits with classical processing. And also we can deal with errors in parallel because we can measure different parts of codes simultaneously. So also such codes are fault tolerant, and I will talk about it later. And of course, there are disadvantages and disadvantages. The main disadvantage is that we, of course, encode less information compared to a general quantum code. Basically, there are not so many known bounds on quantum LDPC code. So basically, even if we come up with some construction, there is no way to know whether it's a really good construction or we have to search more and try to find a better construction. So, however, there are some constructions. And here I would like to talk about the hypergraph product code construction. And this construction basically corresponds to a CSS code, which means that the parity check matrix has such block structure with 2-0 blocks as to shown here. So basically that means that the commutativity condition is simplified to orthogonality of two matrices GX and GZ. So then there is a routine way to construct such codes. Those are called surface codes. So if we have some graph that covers a two-dimensional surface, then what we need to do, we need to place qubits on edges of such graph, and then we associate X stabilizer generators or GX matrix with the vertices of such graph, which means that a stabilizer generator involves qubits that are neighboring to this vertex. And then GZ corresponds to plackets the same way. So GZ stabilizer generator involves those qubits that are neighboring to some placket. So basically, such construction immediately ensures commutativity, and this commutativity can be related to the fact that this graph can be mapped to a dual one, and in this mapping, basically, the placket becomes vertex, and vertex becomes a placket. So then, of course, one could ask a question, can we generalize this construction to an arbitrary graph? In principle, it turns out that, yes, we can. And if we look at Tori code, this construction perfectly works well. So basically, the Tori code can be represented as a product of two cyclic code corresponding to repetition codes with cyclic matrices. However, if one just simply multiplies two arbitrary graphs, one will immediately notice that the mapping will give us a hypergraph as a result of this mapping. So basically, the construction is more complicated than one would assume initially. However, it even works to the best because it turns out that as initial object, we could actually have taken a product of two hypergraphs. And then basically, there are generalized plackets and generalized vertices that can be identified in such a structure. So it also turns out that this construction has a much simpler representation in the matrix form. And basically, the GX and GZ matrices for this construction can be written in this form through Kronecker product, where E here is the unit matrix, and then H1 and H2 are arbitrary binary matrices. And the dimension of this E matrices should correspond to basically the dimensions of the matrices H1 and H2 so that this product of GX and GZ would be meaningful. So then the commutativity of these matrices immediately follows basically from the properties of Kronecker product, and we get a correct quantum error correcting code. However, the advantage of this construction is that we actually know the parameters of quantum codes, of such quantum codes, and they are actually given by the properties of classical codes constructed from parity check matrices H1 and H2. For example, the dimension of the quantum code is related to dimensions of the corresponding classical codes. Or the distance of the quantum code is also limited by, is larger than the minimum distance of four classical codes constructed from matrices H1 and H2. And there are not so many infinite families of codes for which we know exactly the parameters. So this construction is very useful in this sense.
What are the tildes in the GZ?
So tilde means that the size of this matrix is different. So the size of matrix E1 corresponds to the number of columns
okay.
in H1. And this corresponds to number of rows in H1. Okay. So that this kind of product of those would be meaningful.
Okay.
Yeah. So then I guess the most interesting construction that one can obtain from this is the LDPC code with finite rate. So suppose for H1 we take a Gallagher code that I discussed in the beginning. And actually it is known that Gallagher code can be constructed with finite rate and finite relative distance. So if I take H2 to be transposed of H1, and if H1 is the full rank matrix of such Gallagher code, then the parameters of the quantum code can be immediately written. And what one notices here is that the rate of such quantum code is basically of the order of the squared rate of the classical code, which basically means that the rate is finite, and the distance scale is the square root of the block length. So at the same time, because for Gallagher code we had fixed number of entries for rows and columns, we get a weight-limited quantum LDPC code with finite rate and distance scaling as the square root of the block length, which basically looks distance-wise looks like Tory code. However, it encodes much more information. So another construction, which is also interesting, I believe, can be done from LDPC cyclic code. And we can also immediately obtain the parameters of the corresponding quantum code. So why this construction is interesting? Because basically the stabilizer generators become translationally invariant. So basically here's an example of one of such codes that encodes 98 qubits and has distance 5. And this code, there are these two stabilizer generators, which are corners. And all others are basically obtained by translations over the same sublattice with periodic boundaries. So this kind of compares quite well to Tory code, because we added simply four Pauli operators in our stabilizer generator, and we encode much more information. And in one of the gauges, basically, the logical operators can be represented in such form. So basically, they're all line-like objects, and they with dotted lines. And they have only one representative in this gray square. And there are 98 qubits in this gray square. So basically, this basically corresponds to torical representation. However, of course, if we start deforming these logical operators by stabilizer generators, of course, they will assume much more complicated form. So I will quickly run through various generalizations of this construction. So one of the generalizations we came up with corresponds to actually rotated boundaries. And this construction has been known for Tory codes, and this is how one obtains so-called checkerboard code. And what's important here that we actually get two distinct situations here. Sometimes we get codes that encode two qubits, and these are CSS codes. But we also get non-CSS codes that encode one qubit, and then the stabilizer generator is only one stabilizer generator, and it has form XZZX, and all others are obtained by translations. So, and those are termed bipartite and non-bipartite cases. And what's interesting is that within this construction, if we allow angle of boundaries to be different from 45 degrees, we can also represent 513 code as a Tory code, and this is basically the smallest known quantum error correcting code. So it's very interesting that this construction actually also works for hypergraph product code, and this non-bipartite construction, non-CSS construction, let me just define it, that it's given by such kind of matrix, and here H1 and H2 are also binary matrices as before. However, now we require that they're symmetric matrices. And again, the parameters of such series of codes is known. And also one can come up with a construction which would have finite rate and distance scaling as square root of the block length. So basically what one can do, one can again take the Gallagher code and take P parity check matrix from Gallagher code and symmetrize it according to this precision. And basically by doing simple analysis, one can come with this conclusion about the rate of such code. So here is a quick example. So here is a Tory code or checkerboard code, and here is example of hypergraph product codes. So indeed, for this code, we get only one stabilizer generator, and it's kind of 45 degrees rotated with respect to boundary, and all other stabilizer generators are obtained by translations of this one. So the bipartite case, which corresponds to CSS codes, looks slightly more complicated. And here again, there is some more involved matrix structure. However, in the end, we again get a CSS code. So commutativity can be again checked basically by, again, the Kronecker, the properties of Kronecker product guarantee us the commutativity of these codes. And then also by the similar arguments, one can again conclude the parameters of such code. And what we get here, we get this factor 1/2, which is not nice. However, we came up with a construction on, in which actually we can remove this 1/2 factor here. So am I right in the conditions here? So basically for such kind of choice of matrices B and, I did not write about it, but basically our motivation for this construction was that in some situation, this construction allows us to construct codes that have the same distance as hypergraph product code, the same number of encoded qubits, but it requires twice less physical qubits. So again, an example of such construction, so again, stabilized generators are rotated 45 degrees with respect to boundaries. And this construction corresponds to a code that encodes 50 qubits and has distance 14, and 14 is larger than the weight of this stabilizer generator, which basically means that this is a degenerate code. So now I would like to proceed to the next part of my talk, and here I would like to analyze asymptotic properties of such hypergraph product, of such LDPC codes. And basically the idea is that we have a construction, explicit construction at hand, construction of hypergraph product code, and by that we can actually formulate the lower bound on the parameters of quantum codes. Of course, it may turn out that this bound can be improved. However, because there is nothing else available, this is the bound that really exists at the moment. So the idea is that we will use the results that are known for classical LDPC codes. And for those, there is a counting argument, which is called Gilbert-Varshamov bound. And basically this counting argument, which is based on greedy argument, basically guarantees us existence of code with some asymptotic parameters, but in particular with some finite rate and with some finite relative distance as a function of the weight of our parity of element, as a weight of rows and columns of the parity check matrix. And basically here just some algebra which will translate inter parameters of the quantum error correcting code. So basically there is a rate, finite rate of our quantum error correcting code, and there is a distance that scales as square root of the block length. And actually we know this coefficient from this bound for classical codes, and here is the graphical representation of this result. Basically on the left, this is the bound for classical codes, and the red line corresponds to a general classical code. So basically, if there is no LDPC requirement, and CNR is weight of rows, of columns and rows, and as you can see that we have to pay a price for LDPC structure because we are below the Gilbert-Varshamov bound for a general code. However, we are still achieving a finite rate and finite relative distance for such LDPC codes. And this will translate into a quantum error correcting code where again we have bounded rate for column and row weight. As a result, we get codes with finite rate and distance scaling as the square root of the block length. So.
Maybe you're going to say this later, but in terms of the product that I guess is almost C times R, what is it, C minus 1 times R of the graph?
You mean in product in terms of this coefficient?
No, the degree of the graph.
It's C minus 1 times R.
Okay, so which of those points is the best one for that?
4, 7.
4, 7.
Yeah, that's the best one. So now I'm proceeding to the final part of my talk, and here I would like to talk about fault tolerance of quantum LDPC codes. So I talked a lot today about toric codes, and basically it turns out that we can also get some insight into our general LTPC codes just first looking by looking at Tori code. So basically the idea is that I will start by calculating probability of failure for Tori code, and I will try to relate it to the constructions for general quantum LTPC code. So first, I basically need to identify the situation when my code construction fails or when basically we destroy information stored in the code. So I will try to calculate the probability of such events. So of course, such error is dangerous and it will destroy my code. It will destroy information stored in my code. However, let's see further and let's see if this error is also dangerous. It turns out that this error is also dangerous simply because the stabilizer generators will commute with the middle section of this error, and they will only detect the ends of this error. Then there will be a confusion whether we have to eliminate error in this direction or in the wrong direction, and then basically we might try to correct error in the wrong direction and basically make these things worse. So we need to count all such dangerous situations, and in order to account for all such dangerous things, what I would like to do, I would like to count all regions or all random walks on this two-dimensional surface that have lengths longer than distance of this code. And at the same time, more than half of this walk will be filled with errors. So at first step, I can choose error with L squared possibilities. So first I will throw the first error with L squared possibilities. Then the next step, I will have 2D, where D is dimensionality, 2D possibilities for errors. And then each next step, it will be only 3, which is 2D minus 1. So then, by this expression, I will count the number of all random walks on this graph. Now, I will need to multiply it with the probability that basically more than half of qubits in this walk are filled with errors. And basically, this expression then will give me some bound on the probability of failure. So, and of course, this can be improved. And in fact, in this paper, they give a slightly better bound. But anyway, basically, if I require that this expression exponentially decays as we increase the block size of my code, and basically we can find the error probability threshold below which basically this probability decays exponentially, and I can make it arbitrarily small by basically increasing the block size of my code. So let's see if this idea can also be somehow applied to Tori code. So as I mentioned before, we like to place all qubits on a graph where we connect two qubits only if they share some stabilizer generator. I make an observation that if there is a cluster of errors, and if these errors are connected with each other, and then if there is another cluster, and these two clusters are disconnected with each other, then I can actually correct these two clusters separately. Of course, this becomes only possible if the cluster size is smaller than the distance of my code. So then it becomes obvious that what we need to require that at least we have to be below the percolation threshold of this graph. And because the degree of each vertex is limited, basically this percolation threshold is known for such graphs. And furthermore, if we are below this percolation threshold, basically this simple derivation proves that the probability distribution of clusters will decay exponentially, which means that the typical size of the clusters will be logarithmic in the block length. And if the distance of the code grows as some power of the block length of the code, then we will be guaranteed to be able to correct this cluster. However, things are actually more complicated than this. And the problem is that we don't really know where the errors really happened. So, and the problematic point here again, this example, when we basically know that this the length of this walk is less than distance. However, we still cannot correct it because we don't know in which way to correct it. So we would like also to eliminate such dangerous situations. And then in order to do that, we actually need to do a more careful counting. And what we do here, we actually count all clusters of the size larger than distance of the core. And then we multiply it by the probability that more than half of this cluster is filled with errors. So of course we are overcounting here, and probably a better estimate can be constructed. However, we will guarantee that if that our probability will be bounded by this value. So basically, after some simple algebra, we come up with a result that this probability will be decaying exponentially with the block size below some threshold. And the threshold looks very actually similar to what we got for toric code, where instead of Z for toric code, we had 2D. So we had 3 for toric code. Here we have to substitute Z, which corresponds to the connectivity of this graph. However, we acquired also extra factor E here. And we are still doubtful where this should be here. And we are kind of trying to either to find ways to do counting more carefully or to do some numerical estimate, some numerical analysis in order to see whether this E really has to be here. But anyway, we did establish that there is a threshold, so these codes have to be fault tolerant. The question is, what is the real value of the threshold? This still has to be established. Also, there is another interesting question here, whether this would correspond to some kind of phase transition on this graph, or what is this really, and if some order parameter can be introduced here. Because, for example, for toric code, the transition that happens can be related to random bond Eisen model, a phase transition in that model. So it's an open question whether similar kind of mapping to some phase transition is possible here. So one good thing that we can do here is that we can also generalize this approach to the case when there are also errors in syndromes. And this can be done, for example, by using the Tanner graph representation that I used before. So basically, here qubits corresponds to a layer in which we basically have this graph placed like this. And then we connect each qubit to the syndromes that this qubit involves. Then basically by staring at this graph, one can understand that this graph actually corresponds to the process in which we also have errors in syndromes. And basically, we will be able to correct errors in this enlarged object if the connected regions of this on this graph are less than distance of some effective classical code corresponding to this whole graph. So basically what we need to know, we again need to know the degree of each vertex in this graph, which can be easily found. And then this degree can, then we again can repeat the consideration that we had for a bare quantum error correcting code without errors in syndrome. And the estimate, and we can obtain the estimate for the threshold. So then this is basically a theorem which basically formulates all these results in one place. So basically in case when there are no syndrome errors, we get the estimate for threshold, which I gave you before. Now, if there are errors in syndrome, and of course here I assume that the probability of errors in syndrome is the same as for the qubits. In reality, it might be different, and then of course, the considerations here have to be refined. But if the probability is the same, then all we need to do is we just need to replace z by z prime that I defined in the previous slide. And basically, I can again get the estimate for the error probability threshold. So another question that I posed before about the efficient decoders. So in principle here, as I said, the simple decoders that work efficiently for LDPC codes would not work here. So basically, we are also looking at efficient decoders, or in particular, we would like to see whether some of the decoders that work on toric codes can be adopted to hypergraph product codes. So this is still ongoing research. So basically, these are conclusions. So so basically, we propose to use quantum LDPC codes for quantum error correction, and we show that they actually can give advantage of the toric codes. And furthermore, we establish fault tolerance of such codes and show that basically Tanner graph representation becomes very useful for that. And I also showed several explicit constructions of quantum LDPC codes. So of course, the questions that I probably already mentioned in my talk about topological order associated with this hypergraph product codes, about design of efficient decoders, and also if the phase transition can be associated with the error threshold on those graphs. So yes, that's it, I guess. Yeah. Thank you for your attention. So I hope there are some questions.
Can you go back to the one where you do the random walks?
Yeah.
The one before this one, this one.
Yeah.
So are those walks supposed to be self-avoiding?
Yes, sorry, I didn't mention. Yes, these are self-avoiding walks, because it's basically, if it hits itself, then it self-annihilates that section that hit itself. So
they're sort of loop erasing, I guess.
Sorry?
They're loop erasing, but there's a uniform measure on them, right? So they all have the same weight.
Yeah, no, they if it, the walk hits itself, it becomes kind of... It's not error anymore. It kind of self-corrected itself, because all loops can be constructed as combinations of stabilizer generators. So they're those errors that are not dangerous, that degenerate errors. So then there is a chance that error by mistake corrects itself.
Yes.
So like there is error here, then if error happens at the same place, it eliminates itself. But there is another way to eliminate errors, and that just to create a loop, and loop is not a dangerous error. So I don't even need to consider
it. But it's a process, right? So it steps from one side to the next.
Yes, it's the process, but because we need to bound it, if I take into account, I can probably improve this bound, but this bound is already very crude.
Sure.
So that, I don't know.
I mean, you can easily improve it, but yes. You know, using connected quantum software walks.
Mm-hmm.
So it brings it brings a 3 down to a 2.6 or so. Right?
Oh,
it's not a big improvement.
Yeah, I think it's mentioned in this paper.
Yeah,
that improvement. Yes.
But there is a process which is called loop erasing self-avoiding walk. It's a self-avoiding walk, which steps from side to side. But every time it creates a loop, it erupts out the loop, and then it continues from where it did.
I see.
So that's a process. I don't know much about it. I just know that this exists in the literature. But I don't know if that will really help you here. But it might be.
It might be. But the thing is that I use this only as demonstration of what we try to do on graphs. And on graphs, we don't even consider walks. We just count all connected
clusters.
Yeah, all clusters on the graph. Yeah. So
the next page. So you go to the next page. Mm-hmm. So that random graph you have there, is there some local property to it, or is it
local?
A local property. Is the diameter of the graph bigger than some number? By the diameter, I mean the largest distance between any two vertices. Because it's a random graph, if you pick any two vertices, there's a shortest path between it.
Yes.
Now, is there a condition on that shortest path?
We demand that the degree of each vertex is limited by some number.
Yeah.
But Apart from that, of course, we would like it, I get to see it to be large enough because, for example, so that this exponential decay will kick in. So
AST is the number of clusters containing X?
AST is the number of clusters that contain X and that has S number of vertices in it and the boundary T. So this is basically the probability distribution of cluster sizes.
Sure. Okay.
So of course we don't want to deal with some finite size effects. So we want n to take n to infinity basically in order to show basically what happens when n is large. But I guess you are right that for small n there might be some problems.
No, I'm just wondering how you define percolation event itself, right? Because if you think about square lattice percolation, there's, if you take the lattice size to infinity, the distance between vertices on the boundary goes to infinity. But here, I don't know if that necessarily happens.
But so
the diameter might stay small. But
These tend to be expander graphs, you said? Since it's a bounded degree graph,
sure,
the diameter can't be constant; it has to grow.
It has to grow,
but it tends to be like log n, I think.
It has to grow because it just will have to, there is no way.
But presumably you can define percolation maybe in its, I'm not sure exactly what the definition would be, but certainly if you're below the percolation threshold for this graph, you'll have, disconnected clusters. That's kind of, that's what you're really counting here.
Yeah.
And then presumably at percolation, you get these big connected clusters. That...
Yeah. So underneath the percolation threshold, you get this exponential decay that he's talking about.
Yeah.
And one way of showing it is, in fact, we're using these clusters. You count the clusters, you estimate AST. Once you've estimated that, you get this exponential decay. Above the critical point, it's a stretch exponential, right? I don't know, for standard percolation, the proof is quite general. So I think it applies in all sorts of situations. It doesn't have to be a lattice, which is a square lattice. It can be a random lattice. I believe it will work. It's due to Eisenmann. Eisenmann is never comes up, but it's a hard
But we don't even need to go up to percolation threshold eventually.
Yeah.
So basically, this was our initial kind of line of thoughts. But then basically, the real threshold is much below. So you see here, there's z squared. So this is much below. So we never go.
You never go into the supercritical.
Yes, we never go. We never even come close to the percolation threshold in reality. Because this is, as I said, it's a question whether this transition will correspond to some order parameter on such graph. So we kind of don't know.
Presumably it does.
So and in fact, for toric code, there is mapping. You can map it to random Born Eisen model.
Sure.
So if you switch to erasure errors, where the errors announce their locations.
Yeah, for erasure, I can use this bound, basically, because if I know where the error is and if the size of the error is smaller than the distance, then it can be correct. So and in fact, we actually used that to formulate some upper bound on the LDPC code.
Uh-huh.
However, it's also a question how good is that.
But so going to the question you asked at the end about relationship between the percolation threshold and the error correction transition.
Mm-hmm.
So from what you're saying that the for general errors for unlocated errors, the error correction threshold is going to be far below the percolation threshold because you need really pairs of errors.
Yeah.
But maybe for erasure errors, it's similar or the same?
Yeah, for erasure errors, we will know the position of those. So basically, this will be the transition point, or at least we can estimate it. I mean, of course, there are these super critical regions, and then the question becomes more complicated. However, I will know for sure if error threshold is below this percolation threshold, then I will be able to correct all erasure errors. So that.
But it might be possible to do it higher as well.
Yes, because but it's kind of it's more involved, I think, the analysis of this supercritical region. I mean, we looked at some papers and it looked quite complicated. And it basically depends a lot on concrete structure of your graph.
I think it might. In the supercritical phase, many of the theorems are quite general, mm-hmm. but they tend to be really hard, and they might rely on some local property of the graph, right, in your case. They might rely on the fact that you have a square lattice, where cubic lattice, where nearest neighbor vertices are close in space, mm-hmm. right, and next nearest neighbor. Right? So there's no long edges, if you wish, mm-hmm. present. It might be relying on something.
Yeah.
Typical result is a stats exponential.
Yeah, so if we could use those results, in principle, we probably could have improved this result on upper bound that we formulated for the rate of LDPC codes, but it seems to be like requires some work, more work than this simple analysis.
Thanks.
Okay, thank you.